Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today, we will continue to open the lines to get your thoughts on this political moment. The No Kings protests on Saturday marked the largest mass mobilization since Donald Trump returned to office and came at the end of a week filled with unprecedented actions from the administration, including federalizing National Guard troops and deploying active military to California after people took to the streets to protest ICE raids and public detainments in Los Angeles. Last week, the country's most senior Latino leader, California Senator Alex Padilla, tried to ask Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem a question at a press conference. And as he was doing that, authorities ejected him from the room, forced him to the ground, and handcuffed him. We'll also talk about major Supreme Court decisions, which we are expecting any day now, the recent political assassinations in Minnesota, and the rise of political violence in this country. Also, what it will take to stop Trump's slide toward authoritarianism. So there's a lot to discuss, and we'd love to hear your thoughts on what you make of this political moment. You can join us at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. How are you keeping up with so much happening right now? And what are your thoughts about the weekend's protests, the political assassinations, and where we are in this moment? Today, we're joined by Lisa Graves, founder and executive director of True North Research, a national investigative watchdog group that works with journalists and researchers to shine a bright light on the dark money fueling regressive agendas targeting vital public institutions. Lisa is author of the forthcoming book, Without Precedent, How Chief Justice Roberts and His Accomplices Rewrote the Constitution and Dismantled Our Rights. She's contributor at Legal AF Midas Touch, co-host of the 5-8.5 podcast, writer of Grave Injustice, which you can find on Substack, executive director of True North Research, and managing director of Court Accountability. Lisa Graves served as senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as deputy assistant attorney general in the Justice Department, chief counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a deputy chief of the Article III Judges Division for the U.S. Courts. Hi, Lisa. Congratulations on your forthcoming book, and thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, Rose, it's so nice to hear your voice, as always, but also in conversation with you, and so wonderful to be invited to speak with your listeners.
Well, it's great to have you, Lisa. You're doing so much right now, writing a Substack about the Supreme Court, you're co-hosting a podcast, you're coming out with a very important new book about Chief Justice Roberts and the Supreme Court, and then you have so much interesting experience working at the DOJ, on the Senate Judiciary Committee. So, gosh, I just wonder, an overall kind of a big question, but given your experience, what do you think about this political moment right now? I mean, so much of what we're seeing is just unprecedented.
It really is unprecedented. And I didn't anticipate that when I chose the title for the book, which was Without Precedent, mm-hmm. about the John Roberts decisions on the Supreme Court. But we are in unprecedented times. And, you know, I've been part of some conversations earlier this year with some folks in academia and the political world who were sort of pondering, is this a constitutional crisis? Is that a constitutional crisis? And it seemed a lot like, you know, that old notion of a debate or a philosophy of how many angels can stand on the head of a pin. Because my perspective is that we've been in a constitutional crisis since John Roberts orchestrated the ruling giving Donald Trump unprecedented immunity from criminal prosecution, which signaled to some parts of the American people, of the populace, that he did nothing wrong on January 6th, and in fact could do no wrong if he was acting in his so-called official capacity. And that helped pave the way for Donald Trump's return to power, and not just his return, but his return emboldened to consider himself to have king-like powers. And so we've been in a constitutional crisis now for almost 12 months since that really repugnant decision was issued. And there have been some serious inflection points over these past few months as we've seen this rising authoritarianism from this administration and these outbursts of just lawlessness and activities that we've never seen our government undertake, like masked men seizing people, kidnapping them off the streets of our cities without any notion of, any badges and that sort of thing being shown. I know we saw a little bit of that during the first Trump administration in Portland, but now we're seeing it as a matter of broader policy. So I think America is in a constitutional crisis. That crisis continues, but there are real signs of hope. I think that the protests around the country this past weekend, which were really, live, nonviolent marches in solidarity as part of the No Kings effort, that is really inspiring, and it really shows and demonstrates how the American people, in general, are not on board for this extremism.
Lisa, I always like to ask guests why they think Trump won again. So Kamala Harris got 75 million votes, Trump got 77 million. After the family separation, after the horrible things he said about women, which we hardly talk about, I mean, you can go down the line. Why do you think he won again?
I think there are a couple of reasons. One, I would just say that when you look at all the votes cast in this past election, actually 79 million people voted for someone other than Trump. So a majority of Americans voted for people other than Trump. Fewer than voted for Trump voted for Kamala Harris, but then there were a couple million other voters who also didn't vote for Trump. So he doesn't have, some mandate at all. He barely won. And he won in part, I think, because of just the power of the propaganda machine on the right. The idea that President Biden and Kamala Harris were somehow responsible for the price of eggs, when in fact that's due to other factors in terms of bird flu and price gouging also by some of the big grocery companies, just like we saw with the price gouging around gas prices. And just as we've seen big corporations sort of boost the costs of goods, basically claiming that it's because of gas prices, but then when gas prices go down, the prices of our groceries don't go down. So, but the propaganda machine that the right has was very effective at selling that lie and selling that lie to low information voters, people who weren't paying much attention to politics, but who were seeing, real challenges in their pocketbook at the grocery stores. And so, of course, as soon as Trump gets elected, they, that issue of eggs stops being the top line issue on Fox and the punditry on the right. And in fact, Trump starts saying things like things are going to cost more. That's just what's going to happen with his new trade policy, et cetera. So there was a massive propaganda operation that really was successful in targeting some of those low information voters and getting them to come out for Trump, like as a change candidate, that somehow he was supposedly going to do something about this, like he cared, which I don't think he does at all. But the other part is that that is part of a larger challenge, which is that the right wing sort of information stream is really loud and widespread in America, and it has been engaged in not just, political news stories or political shows, but has really become a part of the culture, the American culture and culture on the right, where you see, the power of Joe Rogan and his podcast to reach so many voters. Some people call that election the podcast election because Trump reached 10 times more people through podcasts than Kamala Harris, according to one of the reliable analyses of, how wide was the reach. That wasn't just because she didn't go on the Rogan podcast. It was because the right concentrated efforts in that realm, which is a really dominant way for people to receive their news. So, some of it was technology in terms of how the parties were different, how the parties and the outside groups were targeting voters, and some of it was the lie machine that Trump has really ridden to power on for the first time and this time. I guess that would be my baseline assessment.
And I wonder how you think about the word democracy, because we hear that word on a regular basis now. And I think about the Electoral College and how undemocratic that is. I mean, Trump is the first Republican candidate to win the popular vote in 20 years. When people often say, can a woman win in this country? I think, well, Hillary Clinton got more votes than Trump. We often forget this. Yeah. I mean, it's such a twisted system. When you talk to people from other countries, they just don't get it. How can someone win but then lose? So that's one question. And then when you look at the Supreme Court, five of the justices were appointed by a president that lost the popular vote. So when you think about that, what does democracy even mean in this country?
Yeah, those are really great questions, Rose, as always. You know, I think when you look at the American electoral system and different components of it, it's almost like whenever you look more closely, you go, wow, that's a big flaw. Like, why is that the way we do things? And the Electoral College is one of those things that is distorting. It's deeply distorting because it gives people in Wyoming more power in that Electoral College than the combined populace in California. And so because the Electoral College gives states votes based on both the two U.S. senators and their population, the fact is that Wyoming's votes under the Electoral College process basically outweigh the votes of big cities in California and other states, quite frankly. And that is profoundly undemocratic, counter-democratic. And then I think there are other things that are just these historical remnants. Like, why is our election in November, in a wintry month where it's hard for people to vote? Why are these deadlines for getting the vote certified so short when we have so many people, so many votes to count in this modern era? Why don't we have voting be like it is in Oregon, where you get a driver's license and you're automatically registered to vote rather than have to go through all this these other procedures that Republicans typically want to impose to make it harder for Americans to vote? So there are a lot of problems that have really allowed minority rule in this country in some significant ways. And as you point out, the U.S. Supreme Court, most of the judges on the U.S. Supreme Court were appointed by presidents who did not receive a majority vote. And they were also approved by a Senate that did not represent the majority of Americans, because the Senate itself is also a counter-democratic institution in the sense that it provides equal representation to each state, regardless of how many people live in that state. And then we've seen this counter-democratic majority on the U.S. Supreme Court change the rules in the middle of the game to make it easier for these Republican state legislatures to game the system and entrench themselves in power through maps that basically crack and pack Democratic voters in such a way that, but for the Supreme Court's decisions and inaction in the 2022 election, the Democrats would have held the House. It was the Supreme Court's rulings that allowed Mike Johnson to become the Speaker of the House in 2023 after those 2022 midterms. And right now we're seeing a House that's closely divided, that again, if the rules that had been in place before the Roberts Court started dismantling them were in place, we would have a Democratic majority in the United States House right now. So democracy is something that has an indefinite meaning, but its purpose, when we think of our aspirations, is to help secure our rights, to help secure our freedoms. And as a way to have a representative democracy, that's what the country is supposed to be in principle. But what we've seen is that some of the rules that the United States operates under don't actually secure a representative government for us, do not secure maps that help us be fairly represented in Congress. And instead, the Supreme Court has allowed deeply distorting maps to take hold in state after state in ways that allow minority rule, or in some instances like Kentucky, sort of create a supermajority where there wouldn't necessarily be a supermajority if the maps weren't so distorted, like splicing up cities and university towns. So in Kentucky, you know, a Democrat can win statewide office as governor, but the legislature remains entrenched in Republican power. Similarly, in Wisconsin, where I've lived for a number of years, we can have a Democratic governor and a Democratic attorney general, but because the Republicans cut the lines on the maps, they have distorted the maps, the Republicans control the state legislature, although that's about to change because of the change in the Wisconsin Supreme Court.
Lisa, you're bringing up so many important points here, and I want to talk about the Supreme Court in a minute, but first, I think what's so dangerous is that we're constantly told that this country is so divided and polarized, and yet you have 90 million people who did not vote. So when people say half of the country voted for Trump, that's just not true. People say it's split, right? That's not true because 90 million people don't vote. But then the other thing is when you drill down and look at issues, people are actually not that divided. And ProPublica has a really important piece from a couple of weeks ago by Jeremy Kohler called Red State Voters Approved Progressive Measures, Republican Lawmakers Are Trying to Undermine Them. And this is so important. There's so many examples out there. So in Missouri, the 2025 legislative session was dominated by Republicans trying to reverse two major measures that voters put on the ballot and approved just months before. One made abortion in the state legal. The other created an employee sick leave requirement. Republicans in Alaska and Nebraska moved to roll back sick leave benefits that voters approved last year. Legislators in Arizona are pushing new restrictions on abortion access, even though voters approved protections 6 months ago. And then one more example. Republicans in Florida, Utah, Montana, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Arizona, Ohio, North Dakota, and South Dakota have approved efforts to restrict citizen-led ballot initiatives. So they want to make it harder for voters to change laws outside legislators. I mean, we're seeing things like Medicaid expansion and increased minimum wage. These are passing in states that voted for Trump. But then once they pass, Republicans are trying to overturn them. So that's why I just can't stand this. We're so polarized. And we hear this in the media all the time. And I just don't think that that's true when you drill down and look at specific issues.
You are so right. You are so right, Rose, because the fact is that there's a wide degree of consensus among Americans, certainly a substantial majority, that support progressive policies like paid sick leave and abortion access and expanded access to other benefits. When voters are, and people, whether they're voters or not, are polled, these progressive ideas, increasing the minimum wage, for example, these are widely popular with ordinary people, regardless of party. Similarly, the polling about the Supreme Court, you know, wide agreement that this court is acting in a partisan way, is not actually acting like a court in defending our rights. On a whole host of issues, Americans actually have a high degree of consensus. For example, there's also consensus even in the immigration polling that people should not just be unilaterally thrown out of the country without due process, which is, you know, what our Constitution requires. So on issue after issue, there's actually a wide degree of support for common, you know, common ground, common ideals, common policy goals. But what you see, as you point out, and as ProPublica documented, is that when the public gets its way, when it has a chance to vote on those issues directly, what we see is a really grotesque disrespect, almost entirely by Republican legislators, who then attempt to repeal what the public wants, to overturn it. We see that in Ohio, Louisiana, other states that you point out, where after an enormous battle to have their voices heard, to have the opportunity to make direct changes to the law, to say, like in Ohio, that they do not want these restrictions on abortion, the Republican legislature attempts to ignore the people's will, and they do so in part because they control the maps, and so they know, because of this really disgusting, quite frankly, gerrymandering that the Republicans have perfected with the help of, you know, computer-aided map drawing to basically, you know, draw maps. There's one legislator in Wisconsin, this was on the cover of the Rolling Stone a couple years ago, there's one legislator in Wisconsin where the map was drawn, like, to basically go down his block, pick up his house, like a little finger, and then circle back and pick up these other red suburbs so that he would have a safe seat. And everyone around him in his neighborhood couldn't vote for him because the map, he doesn't actually represent his neighborhood. It was designed to give him a safe seat. What does that mean? That's, I think, the driver of divisiveness and extremism, because that Republican legislator doesn't have to listen to Democrats or independents or moderates to win. That Republican legislator just needs to win his primary, meaning he has to defeat someone who wants to pull the party even further to the right, or she has to do so. And then in the general election, because the map is designed statistically to make sure he wins no matter what, he doesn't have to do anything that the people actually want, that the public wants. He only has to do what a majority of his party wants. And his party meaning the people who the map has been drawn to decide who elects him or re-elects him or her. And that is just so awful. That's what's causing these legislators to act so in such an emboldened way, to think that they not only have the right to overturn the will of the people, but that they can get away with it because they control the map drawing. And that's why the U.S. Supreme Court's decision, that's why John Roberts' efforts as the Chief Justice to obliterate longstanding federal case law around map drawing, gerrymandering, and the like, is so fundamentally destructive of our democratic process. And by our democratic process, I mean our ability to have fair representation, our ability to have legislators who will be responsive to the will of the majority of the American people, not just to the will of the minority of people in their, of the majority of people in their party, in essence, in a map that's specifically drawn to secure them from any accountability.
And this reminds me of this study that came out, gosh, back in 2014 by Princeton professors. And they reviewed answers to about 1,800 survey questions asked between 1981 and 2002 on a variety of public policy issues. And they broke down the responses by income level. And they found that when a majority of citizens disagree with economic elites or organized interests, they generally lose. Because of the strong status quo bias built into the political system, even when fairly large majorities of Americans want policy change, they generally do not get it. And so that's because of what's baked into the system with gerrymandering, voter suppression, dark money, everything you just laid out there, Lisa, the Electoral College. How do we change that? I mean, I still wonder why the Democrats didn't do more to change the Electoral College back in 2000. But how do we change this when these issues don't even really get the attention they deserve?
Well, it's vitally important that we find some ways. There are some things that some innovations that have been underway to address this, like ranked choice voting, which, of course, elitist, regressive people, in my view, like Leonard Leo, you know, are strongly opposed to. They don't want ranked choice voting where people have a chance to vote for more than one person. And then that would, you know, increase the diversity of representation in our elections by not just having it be sort of winner take all and you can't vote for your second choice and help them win. Or where if someone votes for a third party candidate, they're basically taking votes away from the person closest to them, perhaps, and enabling the candidate that's farthest away from them to win, with the third party candidate being a spoiler in some of these electoral races. And so it's a huge problem. And I think that that's partly why, as you point out, Rose, so many people don't vote, that there are millions of Americans who feel like it doesn't matter. And that their voices aren't heard and they have to work and they can't get off that day. It's not a day off to go vote. They may have to drop their kids off in the morning, pick them up at night, and it's hard to vote during the window that voting is available if they don't think that their vote is going to make a difference. And, you know, that sort of voter suppression has been also part of the stock in trade of the Republican Party. They've done a lot of work and their allies have done a lot of work over the years to try to suppress the vote in that way by basically running third party candidates, you know, as stalking horses where they're entirely staffed by Republican operatives. We saw that with Kanye West's campaign a couple of years ago. Or you know, some of the other tactics to try to make people think, oh, both sides are bad, so don't vote. And targeting that messaging to Democrats, potential Democratic voters, to try to help make them stay home or urge them to stay home. While meanwhile, they're supercharging the right wing base with, you know, motivational ads to get out and vote. And so it is a real problem. And the broader problem, I think, that study reveals and that you have described before, Rose, is this idea of even in a better circumstance, would we have legislators who are representing the interests of all the people in their district, including the poorest few, versus just the rich donors or the people who are giving to the outside dark money groups to help them win election, or the lobbyists who have so much access to the legislators. A couple of years ago, I had an interview where I was in Arizona to talk about the American Legislative Exchange Council, and there was a public television show that, you know, would feature politicians and people who were critical of them. And there was a woman who was a guest. Her name was Debbie Lesko. She was a state legislator then. She ultimately became a federal legislator. And she went on that show and she had the audacity to say into the camera, you know, don't worry about the fact that she goes to these ALEC conferences, which are these fabulous events at these posh hotels where the legislators are wined and dined. And, you know, she was, you know, had flown on the private jet of the energy company in her state and was buddies with their lobbyists. Don't worry, she said, because anyone can walk into her office anytime and share their ideas with her, which was an astonishing sort of sleight of hand, because she's not going on vacations with her legislators like she is with the lobbyists. She's not going out to dinner at the best restaurants in town, having the lobbyists put down their credit card for all the booze and the wine and the, you know, crab or steak or whatever. Those ordinary people do not have that kind of access to her, and she knows it. She relished her opportunity to party and rub elbows with the powerful companies, the big donors that go to those ALEC meetings, and that's unfortunately that type of thing that ALEC has created for state legislators, where they go off to conferences twice a year where they're sort of treated a little bit like royalty and they're wined and dined and schmoozed and boozed, where they meet people to donate to their campaigns, lobbyists and the like. I mean, that is not the type of thing that an ordinary person can afford to do. You know, and we shouldn't have to, in order to get access to our legislators or equal access to our legislators, we shouldn't have to be major donors in order to have our voices heard and have policies reflect the will of the American people. But there is a corrupting influence in the money that has been allowed to be spent around our legislative processes, and around our elections in ways that do distort policy, and I think that do make it easy for some people to feel like it doesn't matter. I would say it really does matter, even though we haven't succeeded on all those policy issues. And if we don't continue to vote, if we don't continue to try to be part of the process, then the law will be even more distorted toward these corporate or special or super rich interests.
We're going to take a quick break. Today, we are speaking with Lisa Graves, an award-winning investigative researcher and author of the forthcoming book, Without Precedent: How Chief Justice Roberts and His Accomplices Rewrote the Constitution and Dismantled Our Rights. We are waiting for a number of very important decisions to come down from the Supreme Court. They'll happen any day now. One major case would require that. Well, Obamacare requires that most private insurance companies provide free preventative care without copays and deductibles to adults and children, and there's a challenge to that. So this is a one that affects all of us. So we'll be talking about some of these cases after a break. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you are in the Bay Area, we are putting two caregiving events together, and we'd love to see you there. This Saturday from 11 to 3 at our 220 Montgomery space in San Francisco, and then July 9th at 6 p.m. for a special live Your Call broadcast at San Francisco's main public library. We hope you can join us this Saturday from 11 to 3 at 220 Montgomery in San Francisco, and on July 9th at San Francisco's main public library. And then coming up tomorrow, since it is June, we are going to open the lines to get your thoughts on what you'd like us to cover in the coming months. How do you want Your Call to meet this moment? If you have a show idea or a guest idea, we'd love to hear from you tomorrow. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. And we'd love to hear your thoughts about this political moment. So much is happening so quickly. How are you keeping up with everything? What are your thoughts about where we are right now? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. We're joined by Lisa Graves, author of the forthcoming book, Without Precedent, How Chief Justice Roberts and His Accomplices Rewrote the Constitution and Dismantled Our Rights. Lisa Graves served as senior advisor in all three branches of the government, Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, Chief Counsel for Nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and Deputy Chief of the Article III Judges Division for the U.S. Courts. She's also a contributor at Legal AF, Midas Touch, co-host of the 5-8.5 podcast, writer of Grave Injustice on Substack, and Managing Director of Court Accountability. So Lisa has done so much incredible work, and if you have any questions about the courts, she is the person to ask. Let's go to a caller. Let's hear from Parker in San Francisco. Hi, Parker. Thank you for holding.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much for having me on, and hi, Lisa. Thank you so much for all the work you've done and for all that you've shared about this. I just wanted to share kind of how I've been feeling in this political moment a little bit. I live in San Francisco. I just went to the protest over the weekend, the No Kings Day, and it felt like there was a big upswelling. I mean, it was beautiful to see that many people out. But I think even just from hearing this, and I think you all have been touching on it, it feels very difficult to hold on to some of that optimism when it feels as though right now the current political structures, and specifically the Republican elected officials, are almost exclusively interested in just holding on to their power without any real, as you mentioned, accountability from their constituents. And I think something you've also touched on, almost a real act of disdain to their constituents. And I think it's just really frustrating, you know? It's hard to be a person in this moment and see all those people come out and see all this and know kind of that background. This is just my comment. It's just been frustrating. So I'd love to just hear something, I suppose, optimistic about this. Tell me out. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Parker. And I'm guessing that a lot of listeners are hearing you shaking their heads saying, I feel you. I have similar experiences. So thank you for that, Parker. What are your thoughts, Lisa? And I'm sure you can relate to Parker.
I can. You know, thank you so much for calling in, Parker, and expressing that, because I do think it is a thing that we all challenge. I tell myself, and I remind myself of some of the great, leaders who have confronted enormous challenges in our country over time, and or have written about them. So, for example, Howard Zinn, the late historian who wrote A People's History of the United States, wrote about how hope is an act of defiance. Holding out hope is an act of defiance, because the people who are trying to repress our rights or limit our rights, they're sort of counting on people giving up and giving in. That's part of that effort to suppress the vote, in essence, is to try to convey to people the inevitability of this system or of this broken system. But it's not inevitable. It's the result of the choices of people. And so because it's the result of choices of people, people can make different choices. We can insist on different choices. And, you know, one of my heroes is Frederick Douglass. He's actually the reason why I named my organization True North Research was in tribute to his paper, his abolitionist paper, The North Star. And he wrote many
you know, beautiful articles about slavery and the fight against slavery. And he also wrote about the, you know, the power of people to respond. And he said, one of the things he said was, you know, there's no, you know, with there, if there's no struggle, there's no progress. He wrote about how, you know, how if we favor freedom, you know, we have to speak out. We have to, he called it agitation. He said, you know, he said people who profess to favor freedom and yet depreciate agitation are like people who want crops without plowing the ground, or want rain without thunder and lightning, or want ocean without the roar of its many waters. And he says the struggle may be a moral one, or maybe a physical one, or maybe both. I think in terms of like speaking, standing up with your feet and going to these marches. But it must be a struggle, because he said power concedes nothing without demand. It never did and it never will. And so that's our moral obligation, is to not give in, to make those demands and make them until they are heard, until we prevail.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Parker. And that's one of the reasons why we're opening the lines. And I think we need to do this on a regular basis, just to find out how people are doing out there, because it does, in some cases, feel like whiplash. And I think the other hard part, Lisa, is how immigrant communities are being affected, how the most vulnerable are being affected. People who can barely make ends meet are going to really be affected by what's going on right now, and not only at the federal level, but also at the state level. We did a show recently about Governor Newsom's budget that calls for major budget cuts to social services. So it's happening at all levels of government. We got an email about the latest on immigration, and I wanted to ask you about this, Lisa. Elizabeth Findell and her colleagues wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal on June 9th called The White House Marching Orders That Sparked the LA Migrant Crackdown. A lot of people were talking about how deportation numbers under Obama and Biden were very, very high. But what makes the Trump administration's moves different is that they're doing it in the light of day. They're grabbing people. They are going to car washes. They're putting people on sidewalks. There's no due process. Families have no idea where their loved ones are. And according to this Wall Street Journal piece, in late May, Stephen Miller met with top ICE officials and said Trump is not pleased because he wants the agency to step it up. And Miller said, quote, go out there and arrest illegal aliens. He says agents do not need to develop a target list of immigrants suspected of being in the U.S. illegally. He directed them to target Home Depot, where day laborers gather for hire, 7-Elevens. He said, who here thinks they can do that? And so what happened? We saw these ICE agents go to Home Depot. And just yesterday, the Washington Post reported that the Department of Homeland Security said it was reversing guidance issued last week that agents were not to conduct immigration raids at farms, hotels, and restaurants. Officials told agency leaders in a call yesterday that agents must continue conducting immigration raids at agricultural businesses, hotels, and restaurants. This is according to two people familiar with the call. So what are your thoughts on this, Lisa? Because we had a couple people on our show last week who are connected to family members whose loved ones work in garment factories, at car washes in LA. They were picked up and they don't know where their loved ones are.
I mean, it really is terrifying and chilling, this weaponization of this agency to pursue the thuggery that Stephen Miller represents. He's someone who would be unlikely to be elected to anything, should not be entrusted with power over anyone, and who has shown demonstrably terrible judgment over and over and over again in almost every, you know, dictate that he makes. This is someone who trained at the knee of David Horowitz, one of the sort of big right-wing propagandists of our time, who passed away recently. Miller is someone who has vile anti-immigrant
views, xenophobic views. And he has been empowered by Trump to basically dictate to ICE, to the Department of Homeland Security, how they should, how they should interpret our laws, how they should impose our laws. And the fact is that this, the crisis that we're facing in terms of the humanitarian crisis of how people in the United States are being treated and mistreated and seized and kidnapped and then spirited away without ready access to lawyers, to their family, to a legal process. This is in part because of one of the big lies that Donald Trump and Fox perpetuated leading up to the election, which is this notion that our streets are filled with violent criminal immigrants. It is simply not true. It was a falsehood all along. That's not to say that there are no immigrants who commit crimes, just as there are not, you couldn't say that there are no Americans who commit crimes. But the fact of the matter is that people who have committed crimes in the United States, who are immigrants, at the end of their prison sentence, they are transferred into federal custody and removed from the United States. Or they were remaining in federal custody while they were awaiting removal if the country didn't have diplomatic relationships with the United States. And so it is not the case that our streets are filled with criminal immigrants. In fact, what the case is that our United States economy is built in part on immigrant labor, on the labor of people who are without papers, but who work hard and are trying to make a living and are law, are abiding the law, other than they don't have the papers to be here, but they're not anyone to be afraid of. But there's been this effort by people like Miller and by Trump to vilify immigrants, to scapegoat them, and to target them as a show of force. And it has caused an absolute chill in all of our neighborhoods, in neighborhood after neighborhood, whether it's the Home Depot, the guys who are showing up because they want to, earn some money helping to trim hedges, or the nannies in Los Angeles who have been seized at the parks and their children left in the children that they're watching left in federal custody. Maids at hotel rooms that are making $2.13 an hour plus whatever tips people leave for them picking up their wet towels off the floor. Restaurant workers who are working, probably far more than an eight-hour shift to, prepare the food or wash the plates or make sure that, that these restaurants survive. We have an immigrant workforce in this country that is super hardworking and that is not engaged in violence, just as we have a workforce of American citizens who are hardworking and not engaged in violence. And what we have in the face of this reality of how much our economy is intertwined with immigration, both immigration with visas and people who overstay visas, as well as immigrants who've come across the border, the fact is that what America has not faced is the reality of migration, patterns of migration with people fleeing terrible circumstances in their home country. We haven't contended with the number of people who are in the United States who have relatives abroad, but who have no way to get the proper papers because of, really flawed immigration policies in order to come visit their parents or their children in the United States. We have an employment policy that does not have proper measures to recognize agricultural and itinerant migrant workers who plant our crops and harvest our fruits, to have them have a way to be lawfully present in the United States and to lawfully transit the border to see their family when their family's sick. And so we have an immigration crisis, but the crisis is one of not having laws that recognize the reality of our employment practices and immigration practices and patterns. And instead, we have an administration that is determined to try to basically break the law, abuse the law, and misuse the law in order to make shows of force, to cause fear, to cause terror, to assert power in ways that have been disrupting our families and our communities, and people who are just trying to make a living, just trying to live the American dream. And so I think when history looks back on this period, they will see this administration as hopefully a real outlier. But as you point out, Rose, Democrats have gone along with some of this by trying to basically out-tough the Republicans, out-deport the Republicans in immigration policies. And that has not worked. it doesn't buy peace. It doesn't lead to any, acknowledgement by the Republicans of Democrats in terms of that policy. Just they continue to vilify Democrats. And meanwhile, Democrats are alienating hardworking people who just want a chance to make a living by those policies, those immigration policies you point out of prior presidents. And what we need to have is a real, actual adult conversation in America about the fact that we don't have a violent criminal alien problem. What we have is a 20th century immigration policy that has not been updated to reflect the reality of our economy, of our workforce, and also just the humanity of the fact that people want to be reunited with their families. And we should have policies that do help family reunification rather than split people apart.
The Guardian has an update that's very important. Families arrested in LA ICE raids have been held in basements with little food or water. And in some cases, they have been transferred to a, quote, family detention center in Dilley, Texas. So we'll definitely do an update on this in the weeks to come. We've got a number of callers who've been waiting patiently. I wish we had more time. So let's take a few callers and then we'll get Lisa's thoughts. And thank you all for waiting so patiently. Let's go to Kim in Oakland. Hi, Kim.
Oh, hi there. Thank you very much for taking my call. And I want to first say I appreciate and agree with your guest today. I think the term vile has been used. It's the inhumanity of what we're experiencing is really unimaginable. But my question is, I was at the No Kings protest this weekend and others recently. And one of the things that is concerning to me, I'm a Black woman, is that there's a paucity of Black folks out there. I know that Black women have said that, you know, we're through. We're tired of this stuff. I'm not through. I don't think any of us are through. But in the past, social movements in the past have always been successful by building coalitions. So what are the efforts out here to make sure that the concerns, the issues of everybody, including Black folks, are being addressed? Thank you very much.
Can I ask you a question, Kim? I think this is such an important point that you make. I did read a couple of articles right after the election, especially Black women who said, we are so tired because we show up, we do the work, and then look what happens. And a number of women that I've read in articles said, we need to take a break because here we are again. I just wonder what your thoughts are on that. Kim, are you still with us?
I sympathize with the feelings of being invisible, of our experiences in life, not being valued always. But more important is, where is the outreach to make sure that this is a broad coalition?
Right. Yeah, I wonder, you know, what happened behind the scenes. I think it's a great question, and we should do a panel on this. The 19th actually had a piece called We Don't Have an Option Not to Fight, How Black Women Are Resisting Now. Black women are rejecting narratives that suggest their lack of visibility since November 5th translates into inaction. So we should definitely do a show about this. So thank you for raising that, Kim. Thank you. We don't have that much time, Lisa, but do you have any thoughts on Kim's comment?
Yes. I do think there needs to be broadened efforts to have a really diverse coalition to respond to the crises that we're facing. And I also heard someone say that we also need to think about this like a choir, where, you know, sometimes people have to take a breath and other people continue to carry the note. In order to hold the note, in order to sing that tune, you know, everyone needs some time to recharge. These are extraordinary times that we're in, and it's extremely stressful to see what's happening to people, to see the, you know, Defense Department trying to erase Black history, the Parks Department, you know, removing, you know, amazing historical leaders because they're Black, and then, you know, putting them back in. I mean, we're being confronted with an assault on the truth like America has never seen. And so we do need to support each other and help each other take some space, you know, to recharge. But it's also the case that, you know, a majority of white women voted for Trump. Hmm. A majority of white men voted for Trump. And, we've got to do better. I've got to do better with my white peers to say, stand up, speak out. Do not, give in to this authoritarian, fever dream. Get more people registered to vote, to be determined to get 5 more people registered to vote next year. Like, we can't just rest on the incredible devotion, the tremendous solidarity of Black women in America who have repeatedly stood up for, for democracy, for progressives, and voted consistently to try to protect our rights and our interests, while some people have voted, much more selfishly and much and under the delusion, the siren song of Trump's propaganda machine. So we have a lot of work to do together, but we also need to give each other the space, I think, to recharge, because this fight is not going to, we're not going to win it in a day. We're going to have to do a lot of work over the coming days together, the coming months, and in fact, the coming years and in the next few years, to really try to make sure that our democracy is restored, that our policies and rights are restored, that liberty is not transgressed in this way, and that we do not have a king in America.
Well, Kim, again, thank you so much. We'll definitely do a show about the issues that you raised. I'd love to bring on some of these Black women to find out what they're thinking right now. 30 seconds, Lisa, we didn't have time to get to Supreme Court decisions, but wow, we've got a number of very important decisions expected any day now. Just quickly, what are you watching?
Well, it is going to be a lot of decisions over the next 2 weeks before the court's term ends. And then there'll be decisions on emergency orders throughout the summer and fall, because Trump continues to pursue policies that are in violation of longstanding statutes, regulations, rules, union contracts, and more. So it's going to be a busy year. And I'd love to come back on and talk a little bit more about withoutprecedent.info, my new book, where you can find it, and also about what the court is doing and what we can do about it.
Yes, we would definitely love to have you back. Lisa Graves is founder and executive director of True North Research. She's author of the forthcoming book, Without Precedent, How Chief Justice Roberts and His Accomplices Rewrote the Constitution and Dismantled Our Rights. You can follow Lisa by subscribing to her Substack newsletter called Grave Injustice. She also co-hosts the 5/8.5 podcast. Lisa, thank you for your work, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rose. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.